Welcome, everybody, to this week's edition of Home Centered Sunstone. I'm your host, Stephen Carter. And as you probably know, we're in the run-up to Sunstone's first ever digital symposium. It's going to be happening the last week of this month, the last weekend of this month, July 29th through August 1st. And it's all going to take place on the Whova app, which means you can access it on your smartphone, on your tablet, on your computer, and even on your Peepstone if it's Wi-Fi enabled. So I'm happy to report that you won't just be sitting around on your butt all weekend watching people give presentations from their home offices. We're actually planning a lot of social stuff so that you can connect with all your old buddies from symposiums past and hopefully make a few new ones. So to get more information, head over to sunstone.org, and we're really excited to see you over there. So let's dive into today's discussion with the eyebrow-raising title of What Happens When White People Talk to White People About Race? It kind of sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit. But the idea for this panel discussion came from a passage I read in the book So You Want to Talk About Race by Ijoma Oluo. In it, she says, quote, "White people talk about race with other white people. Take some of the burden of racism off of people of color. Bring it into your life so that you can dismantle racism in the white spaces of your life." And the thing that came to my mind was, how can white people talk constructively about race together? And the more I thought about it, the more I didn't know. In fact, I found myself having to sort of whittle the question down to simpler and simpler terms until I ended up with, well, what even happens when white people talk with white people about race? Like, how do the conversations start in the first place? What do they try to do? When do they take sudden turns? How do they end? And I realized that I didn't know any of the answers to these questions either. So I gathered some of my white friends to get the thinking started. Now, I didn't gather these two because they're race scholars. In fact, as far as I know, neither of them have any training in race relations. The reason I brought them together here today was because they're smart, they're thoughtful, and as far as I know, they want to do good in the world. And I wanted to see what smart, thoughtful people who want to do good in the world would do with this question. What happens when white people talk to white people about race? So I have here with me Karen Peter down here and Liz Martin over here. Karen, would you be willing to introduce yourself?
Certainly. My name's Karen Peter. I am a Sunstone board member, which might be the most important thing to share with our audience right now. But I also am serving as a president of 70 in Community of Christ, which makes me part of the Mormon family of Sunstone as well. I'm a native Northwesterner, which means I like damp weather and I'm usually cranky and I drink an enormous amount of coffee. And all of those things are probably the most important things anybody needs to know about me.
Excellent. Liz, can you outdo that?
I don't think so. Let's see. My name is Liz Martin, and I currently live in Atlanta, Georgia. But I was born and raised and spent most of my life in Salt Lake City, Utah. And I'm a sixth generation Mormon. I've got that pioneer stock. I'm currently in divinity school at the seminary at the Candler School of Theology at Emory University. And prior to that, I worked for the Unitarian Universalist Church, serving as a director of religious education in Salt Lake.
And she was great.
Thank you.
Whenever Liz took the stage, I was like, I'm here. So, as we go into this conversation, I want to make it clear that none of us are here to give you tips or tricks on effective conversations about race. Rather, this is an experiment where we're going to analyze some of the conversations about race that we've had with other white people to see what kinds of patterns crop up. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to learn something from them. And since this is an experiment, we're hoping that our watchers will be willing to tell us what patterns you've seen, both in your own conversations and in the conversation we're about to have, because doubtless some of our ignorance and blind spots are going to show through tonight. So let's start by talking about some conversations that we've had about race with other white people and some things that we've noticed about it. Can I throw the ball into one of your courts?
Yes, I see.
All right, Karen takes it.
We're a little nervous about jumping in here, and I have to admit I'm a little nervous because this really made me think about some of the conversations I've had, that sometimes it's easier to let those conversations go after you've had them rather than rehearse them in your brain and realize you're going to actually talk about them to other people. But just recently, because of all that's happened in our world, because of Black Lives Matter, and I live in the capital city of Washington State, and so it has continued to be of intense conversation in our city. We had a family gathering, and in our family gathering, we had people from teenagers to their 80s. So we had all generations represented around the table, so to speak, and we began talking about the Black Lives Matter movement, and that moved into a more general conversation about race. And we kind of focused on the difference that people, the different way people experience a very common thing, and that is a traffic citation, getting stopped for a traffic violation. And that as white people, our experience is going to be vastly different than it is for Black people. And during the conversation, two things really became clear. First, what became clear is that my family members and I, that it had never crossed our minds before that people had this vastly different experience based on race. And so almost to a person, when we were informed of it, when we began to really look at it, there was this element of surprise that registered on people's faces. True surprise at the reality of injustice so close to us in our community and all around us in our community, and that we had been ignorant of it because we had not experienced it. So that was the first learning in that moment. And the second learning is a little harder to talk about because it was my own kind of self experience. And that was, I found myself both impatient and feeling guilty, somewhat guilty during the conversation. Impatient because I wanted the conversation to move from the reality of what was happening to a solution, and guilty because I wanted that solution to be found so I wouldn't have to identify or articulate or admit how I might contribute or have contributed or have benefited from this very unjust reality. So those were the two things that really stood out for me in this conversation, was my own ignorance and the ignorance of my extended family, all white. And what makes it, I think, even more deeply felt is that we have an African-American member in our family. And yet, it had never occurred to any of us the vastly different way people are treated. So I have other conversations, but I will turn it over to Lisa and see where we go from there.
Okay. Well, when Stephen asked about white people talking to other white people about race, I thought back to the first time I was introduced to this idea. I was at a conference out of state with about 300 other people who were doing the kind of work I was doing, which was working in a church, working with youth and children mostly. And the theme of the conference was talking about hard things. And it was a four-day-long conference. We spent one day talking about death. We spent one day talking about money. We spent one day talking about sex. And one day talking about race. And I was fully prepared for the hardest one to be one of the first three. Not so much about race for me, because I thought, you know, this isn't something that I see much of or deal with very often. living in Salt Lake City, Utah. I think I went into it with an idea that this didn't apply to me. This was some years ago. So we're in this big conference room, hundreds of us, and they asked all of the white people to leave. They said, we're going to do something called caucusing, and we are going to have people of color have their own conversations about race, because how they experience race is very different than those of us who are white. And I was a little bothered by this. I thought, well, isn't the ultimate goal for us all to be one happy family and get along together? Why would you segregate us? Like, isn't segregation the opposite of what we want ultimately, right? But I thought, okay, fine. If I voice my opinion, I will get roped into volunteering next year somehow. So not going to complain. So they sent us all out of the big room, and we had to wait in this hallway with no instructions for quite some time. And it was crowded and it was hot. And we were like, this is really uncomfortable. We don't know what's going on. We don't understand what's happening right now. This is strange that they pulled us apart. And then when they did finally tell us where to go, we were squished into a room that was inadequate for our needs. Absolutely off to the side, away from everyone else. It felt really strange and uncomfortable. And as it turns out, of course, that was part of the lesson, right? That, that there are lots of ways in which, you know, the situations, it didn't make sense, right? It did not make logical sense to us. We couldn't understand. And being a room full of people who work with children and youth, we all wanted to solve the problem and say, the logical thing is for the white people to stay in the big room because we're the biggest group and this is the way it should be. So that was the first part of the learning. The second piece is that we sat around at tables and we had a list of questions to answer about race and how we had experienced race in our lives. And again, you know, I went into this thinking, well, this doesn't apply to my life. And came out of it feeling differently, realizing that, you know, just because I don't know people who are descended from slaves doesn't mean that I don't know people who are descended from indigenous people or from the Pacific Islanders who came to Utah and were, you know, and that they had experienced many of the same kinds of prejudices that African Americans had. And, you know, it made me care about this bigger issue once I started to hear more. The other piece was that it was a really tough conversation. Like, the questions we were asking each other, when people started to realize how hard it would be to be a person of color, a lot of people got really emotional. There was a lot of crying. And I think that's when I realized that why it's important for white people to talk to other white people, because it would be really sucky to be the one person of color at that table trying to make people feel better about how guilty they feel that racism is bad. You know, that was a big awakening for me, that I needed to learn how to talk to my own people and maybe even not just be a bystander when I see things that I don't agree with, just to save them that kind of pain.
That's really interesting. And so it seems like one of the things that is like the other with your two stories is that you were hesitant, and I totally understand your feeling. You were hesitant to stay in the space where, I don't know, where things weren't cut and dried, where you had to sit with being uncomfortable. Karen, you were talking about that. You wanted to get out of...
I don't want to be in the uncomfortable. Yeah, I don't want that. I want to find some solutions. We can all move forward and be happy together, because that, like Liz said, that's the goal, right? We all want to be happy together. So, yeah. And I think that, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I'm thinking about the something that happened here in my own neighborhood. I live in, for Washington, a fairly diverse neighborhood. We have people from multiple ethnic backgrounds in our neighborhood. But the end of the street where I live has traditionally been a whole bunch of retired white people. And it's COVID and there's not much to do. So on Thursdays, if it's sunny, we meet in our neighbor's driveway. And if you are so inclined, you bring your own libation and you sit around and we sit 6 feet apart from one another and we chat. Well, the neighbor, their next door neighbor is a black family that just moved in. And so here's a bunch of white women sitting around wondering why the black man that lives next door won't just come over and invite himself to come and sit with us like all the other neighbors do. And that sparked a conversation about race. And again, it's uncomfortable when you start to unpack why that might be. And I was, as a 61-year-old white woman with my friends in the same kind of demographic, becoming more aware that what does that look like when the I hate the fact that my name is Karen, because what does that look like when white women of my demographic are one of the reasons people of color have a hard time inviting themselves to any party, right? To anywhere where it's an all-white discussion. And so again, what came out of that was we didn't know how to walk over and knock on his door and say, hey, we would love to have you come to our driveway party. We didn't know how to do it, and we didn't know that we didn't know how to do it until we had the conversation.
That's interesting. You didn't, and so the end of this story is very interesting in that you said, the end of this story is that we found out that we didn't know how to solve this problem.
Yeah,
who knew? And so you didn't solve the problem, but you made the step of realizing that you didn't know how to solve the problem, which was a step beyond what you had before. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And that honestly is where that conversation ended on that day. Now, I'm happy to report it went somewhere else later, but on that day, that's where we left it.
So baby steps is kind of what I'm hearing. You guys made a baby step, but you first had to be uncomfortable and then stay in that discomfort of saying, we don't know what to do. But that was the beginning of another conversation.
Yes.
Okay.
Several conversations.
Oh, several conversations. What are your thoughts on this, Liz?
Well, I'm honestly curious about, did you get to the point where you invited
Yes.
Folks to come?
Okay. Yes. It happened the next time we met in the driveway. Uh-huh. Our neighbor, Avery, happened to pull up his garage door as we were gathering over there, and spontaneously somebody just called out, hey, and come on over, and we had a conversation. We've all been more intentional about having conversations with Avery, everyone in our end of the street, so to speak. I think we've each realized that since we didn't know, we each had a personal responsibility to figure out how to do it.
Why do we resist that not knowing space so much? Because I found a lot of conversations where I've resisted it as well. Why does it bother us so much?
We want answers. And we want to solve things. I mean, we live in a society where progress means moving forward and solving problems, and I don't think we get enough practice being uncomfortable. I felt this way in mourning. My mom passed away when I was 27, and nobody knew how to sit with that, right? People just wanted to make it better. People just wanted to tell me things like, don't worry, she's in heaven playing with her future grandchildren. You know, like people didn't want to sit in the discomfort of, I'm really sorry that this bad thing happened, right? So I think it's kind of a universal white people thing, you know, like that we don't want awkwardness. We don't want to see people feeling their real sad emotions or angry emotions. You know, and I think that's one of the differences I've noticed in my classmates. One of the reasons I came to Candler, one of the reasons I chose to come to Atlanta, is so that I could live in a more diverse place and have that experience. Besides the racial diversity, just going to a Christian seminary that, because most of my theology, as I understood it, was Mormon theology, and then kind of my own theology, right? So I wanted to learn a more diverse range of beliefs and ways of living and ways of being. And 50% of my class is identifies as people of color, and there's 190 students in my year. So all of my classes are very well mixed. And for instance, the closest group of friends that I've made at seminary, we all go to the women's prison together on Mondays. Well, we did until COVID. We interned there, and half of the folks there were people of color. And so we ended up deconstructing together a lot what it felt like to be in the prison setting as a person of color versus a white person. And that was really interesting. And it's another one of those spaces where I understood the need for white people to talk to white people too, because I talk about confronting your biases, going into a prison and seeing these folks and making assumptions about what kind of people they are because of the worst thing they ever did in their life, or, you know, really brought up a lot of stuff. So it was really important to be able to bounce things off of not only my whole cohort, but specifically the other white females, because we had a very different experience than, say, you know, the African American men who were going into the prison with us.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
That sounds intense.
Yes.
So you both put yourself out there, and I appreciate that. So now I'm going to put myself out there. A few days ago, I had a conversation with my mom about race, and it was really interesting because, you know, being the director of publications at Sunstone, I feel like I'm pretty good at having, you know, these hard conversations. But as I was talking with her, I started feeling this feeling of fear that was cropping up in me. And like you guys, I kind of was repulsed by it, and I wanted to get away from it. That was the first thing I wanted to do, was to get away from it. But as you guys have been saying, I tried to sit with that discomfort and say, where is this coming from? Instead of saying, oh, I'm a bad person because I'm afraid of this, I thought, you know, this is a feeling that's coming up into me, so obviously it's coming from somewhere. Where is it coming from? And so as I thought about it, I realized that a part of me was saying, you know, systemic racism is real. And if things were equal, I would have to work much harder to keep up because I'm not the smartest or the most talented guy on the block. And so I'm not saying that this is necessarily true or anything, or if it's a deep insight or anything. All I know was that was a fear that was inside of me that suddenly cropped up when we were talking about systemic racism. I suddenly got frightened because I thought, oh my gosh, I'd have to work harder, which is really lame. I'm not going to judge it. It was a fear that came to me, and I had to sit with that, and it was difficult because it didn't say a very nice thing about me. It meant that on some level, I did realize that systemic racism was a thing, and that the more I ignored it, the more I could ride it, right? I don't know. Am I going to get any hate mail on that? Maybe it'll be helpful, huh?
But doesn't that fear and that I'm not wanting to rest in that fear, isn't, to me, it sounds a little bit similar to parts of my own story and to parts of what Liz said about when all the white people were in the hallway and were uncomfortable. And what came out of that was, wait a minute, we're the biggest group. We should be in there because we're the biggest group. We haven't had to experience those uncomfortable situations. We haven't had to experience those fearful situations, or in my experience, the the guilt that came thinking, how have I benefited from this? I haven't had to live in that because I am part of the white majority, part of the big group that should have been in the big room. And that's always been my experience, has been being in the big room. And so all of a sudden, when I find myself wondering, did I benefit? Did I get to be in the big room because of racism? Now that screws up my whole paradigm of how I understand my place in the world, right?
Yeah, it actually reminds me of one of the things that Jesus said. He was talking about when you go to a room, when you go to a feast, and you look at the table, and the table, of course, is supposed to be arranged hierarchically, so the coolest people sit at the top, and the lowliest people sit at the bottom. He said, put yourself at the bottom of the table and let them say, oh, no, 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 no. You should be up further. You should be up higher on the table. And it was a really interesting thing for him to say, because it kind of sounds like he was going in the direction that we're talking about, which is go to the place where you're not comfortable and sit there. Because that's probably the place where you're going to learn the most. I mean, isn't that one of the reasons why he was criticized, right? Was because he hung out with the lepers and the prostitutes and the publicans and stuff like that. It seems like he understood the idea that you learn the most when you're uncomfortable. And the best way to make yourself uncomfortable is to put yourself in a place lower than you think you deserve. I don't know, is that how you guys interpret that particular? I mean, you guys are in theology school, right?
So that is a way I interpret that scripture. There depends on the day I'm preaching it is going to be how I interpret that scripture. But in this situation, yes, it's a wonderful parallel to that. And I think that's a big part of being a Jesus follower or a Jesus believer or however you want to categorize yourself. If you look to the New Testament as a way to understand what it means to be people in community together. And Jesus modeled that over and over again. Not just with the prostitutes and the publicans, but with uppity women and men who didn't have a clue, which is where I think we need to rest as well, that as white women of a certain age, so I'm 61, I'm old enough to remember not being allowed to wear pants to school. Now, I tell that to my grandkids, they can't believe it. I'm old enough to remember where girls didn't have sports to participate. And so it's really easy for me to say, hey, as a female of a certain age, we were discriminated against. We couldn't pass the ERA amendment. What's wrong with this country? But as a white woman, it's okay to claim that. But then I have to turn around and go, wait a minute. As a white person, I've had enormous privilege. And so I can't just rest in this feminist place where I can rail against the machine that has oppressed women. I have to be willing to say I have benefited from that same machine because I'm white. That totally just tosses everything up in the air, and you have to see where all the confetti falls and figure out what you're going to do about that.
And that's a hard thing to do, because whenever we come to a realization or come into a philosophy that really speaks to us and we start to build our lives around that philosophy, we feel like it's hard won and we want to keep it. It's made our lives make sense. And then when we run up against another person or another philosophy, another worldview that throws everything up in the air, it feels like it's destroying all of our hard won wisdom. And we want to keep it, right? And it's probably even more difficult when we've grown up in this philosophy. And then we have to look at it at its very roots. And that attacks our identity.
And our identity as do-gooders. I think you said we want to do good in the world, right?
our identity as do-gooders?
Well, you know, there's something I've been thinking about with that, because that's often how I try to talk to people, is to appeal to some sort of common philosophy that we subscribe to and draw comparisons to the issue of racism, right? Like feminism or LGBTQ rights, right? Like I usually find some sort of common ground with people in those areas and able to use them as pathways into racism. But it occurred to me recently, and maybe you guys don't feel this way, but I can set those aside anytime I want, right? Like if I go into a situation and I sense that being a vocal feminist is going to get me in trouble, I can just keep my mouth shut. But if I were a person of color and I went into a space where I did not feel welcome, I can't pretend not to be what I am, right? Like I've been thinking about that a lot, about being able, having that, I guess the right word is privilege, right? Having the privilege of being able to not have to wear my philosophies on my shirt so that anybody can try to talk to me about them at any time. One of those things.
Yeah. Well, and I think for me as a person of faith in a faith tradition that promotes healing and wholeness, we have to also be honest that Christian tradition has embraced racism and has benefited from racism and continues to propagate racism in all kinds of ways. And even in denominations that are working really hard to eradicate both racism and some of the systems that continue to oppress people, we have racism within our denomination, and because we have racism in our human condition. And that's hard to grapple with as well. So there's this personal dealing with, I don't know what I need to know to have the conversation. But then there's also this corporate reality of, oh crap, I'm going to piss off half of these people if I insist on having this conversation.
Mm-hmm. You've had such a productive pandemic. You listen to all the books you've ever meant to. You listen to War and Peace, The Stand, Middlemarch, and even Infinite Jest? Oh, but you couldn't quite get through In Search of Lost Time? Oh well. And now, you're looking for something just as meaty, but maybe a little shorter? Lucky for you, Sunstone has a treasure trove of audible quality recordings of our best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry at patreon.com/sunstone. Head over and listen to a few of our free episodes, and then subscribe and get access to the best of Mormon thought and experience. Every episode is guaranteed to last less than 46.37 hours. That's our promise to you.
As I look back on the experiences that made me more actively feminist, I realize that took place over many years, over many books, many conversations, and many instances of having my ignorance challenged. And most of this was done in college because, you know, I was taking courses on women's literature and philosophy, and I had access to some brilliant and deeply humane professors who put up with my ignorance. It was amazing. I look back and I say, where do these people get the patience? So I was kind of on the fast track. But it still took me years of study and experience to truly change my worldview and to learn how to act in accordance with it. And so what you guys have just been saying to me is making me think, oh, all of those years, I had the privilege of having those years to make that worldview shift, right? There were still lots of people who were suffering while they were waiting for me to become enlightened. is this, I don't know, I feel like, is it okay to say, we need to have lots of conversations. We need to read lots of books. We need to have lots of experience in order, as white people who have been programmed with American culture, with patriarchal culture, in order to truly make it to that spot where we actually shift our worldview? Or is this some, it seems like that's a natural process. I was on the fast track. I was in college. I was reading. I was talking. But everybody else isn't. How much time do we get on this and still be, I don't know how to say it, good human beings? This feels like something hard to talk about. How much time should we be given to make that worldview shift? I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
I start to feel really, and I think this is one of the symptoms, right? I start to feel really overwhelmed. Like, yeah, there's nothing I can do. It's too big. There's too many people out there who do not want to spend the time to make these differences. And it's too many more people than I can ever talk to. And the problems of racism being so embedded around us, is there's nothing I can do about it. And it just makes me feel hopeless, right? And I think, and I saw Brian Stevenson, who wrote the book Just Mercy, speak in 2017, I think it was. And that was one of his big three messages to us about racism, was to stay hopeful. And he described every little piece moving us forward. Right. And so I guess that's one of the other things I wanted to bring up, like, as a pattern that I've seen, is that when I've spoken with other white people about racism, we get overwhelmed and hopeless and feel like there's nothing, you know, it's too big of a problem for us to do anything. But like you, I mean, yes, it's taken time, but I'm getting there and I'm working on it and I'm recognizing it more. And once you start to see things, you can't unsee them, you know? So the more we can get people to see little pieces of the puzzle, you know, I feel like we can slowly pull everybody.
And what you're saying is interesting, because you're saying when we get people to see the pieces, and I'll have to admit that I need to see the pieces. I just read So You Want to Talk About Race, and it was revelation upon revelation to me. And I feel bad about that.
It's hard not to, right? I mean, and I've known you for a while, and have I ever attempted to talk to you about race?
Nope.
No. have I, you know, I can remember two sermons in the church experiences that we've had together where we talked about race, and I didn't have much to do with it at all. Yet I've been trying to educate myself ever since that conference in 2015. So 5 years now, I've been trying to read and understand this and talk to people. And I'm still, you know, not, I mean, I guess it's that piece that Brian Stevenson talked about, you know, it's individual relationships and individual connections that I think really build us up to a place where more people can understand. But we also can't beat ourselves up for not knowing what we don't know. So maybe the more we do to help each other, the better. I don't know.
And if you're surrounded by white people, to have the conversations with them, I guess.
I look at the difference in my neighborhood just from six white people recognizing what Liz just said, that we didn't know. And so now we all are intentional about making sure that our neighbors feel invited, that we extend hospitality in a new way. And I really believe that that goes beyond our little end of our road. I think it helps us be more intentional when we read the news, when we participate in other conversations, when we have gatherings together. I think because we now know that we didn't know how to have the conversations, it's living with us in every aspect of our life. So no matter what we do, it's there.
Uh-huh. It It sounds to me like you're making a distinction between performing and being present. Because a lot of the stuff that I read on like Facebook and Reddit and stuff, people get uncomfortable saying, well, so now I can't say this, or now I can't criticize that, or now this piece of vocabulary has been taken over, and they're getting frustrated by all the performance things, all the things that you're supposed to do or say or not do or not say. But it kind of sounds to me, Karen, like you're saying that the most important thing that came out of that conversation you guys had at the end of the driveway wasn't a new set of standards that everybody needed to adhere to, but rather being present in the moment when you say, all right, how do I interact with this in a worldview that is outside the one that I'm normally looking at? How can I encounter this in a new way, in not my old programming? So presence, being present with the situation, rather than saying, oh gosh, how was I supposed to perform in this particular kind of situation? Because then if you're doing that, then you're just performing something that somebody already told you how to do. And then you're not performing from your heart. And it seems to me like what we're hoping for is changed hearts.
Yeah. Which... If I'm performing, I'm focusing on me, right? Okay. If I'm intentional and present, to use your word, I'm focusing on the well-being of the other person. And that's what happens when you're in relationship with someone, right? You focus on their well-being, not so much, am I doing something that I'm uncomfortable with? Am I worried about using the wrong words? Absolutely. I'm going to screw up all the time. I find all kinds of ways to be politically incorrect unintentionally, just because I'm learning along with the rest of society. However, if I'm more concerned about the sense of well-being of the other, then the rest of that becomes not unimportant, but I can extend grace to myself and expect others to extend grace to me in those mistakes, because the essential learning is that we're connecting as individuals and caring about the essence of the other. There's an aspect of holy listening that has to take place, right? Where you just rest in this kind of holy exchange.
I've never heard that term before. Holy listening.
Holy listening. Yeah.
And that's what we do when we listen to each other, so that we actually listen to each other. Mm-hmm. Instead of processing everything through our particular political worldview or invisible worldview, the hidden curriculum of our lives. When we go into holy listening, you probably come out the other side changed.
Which might be one of our greatest fears.
I'd say so. I'm terrified of change personally. And when you talk about race and systemic racism, you're talking about huge change, most of it you're not even aware of.
Right. And I think that's part of the heart change is being willing to be wrong, being willing to make mistakes, and being willing to own them. You know, I think the more I learn, probably the more I realize I make mistakes, right? I mean, the more... You know, and I think at this point, there's no way for me to exist and be whole and authentic without making those mistakes. And it's making me more patient with other people. Like you said, extending that grace, being wanting people to extend grace to me and therefore extending grace to other people.
You guys are bringing up something pretty interesting. I'm realizing as we're talking here that most of the time when I'm in conversation with people, especially socially, usually the way the conversation goes is that you build a value, you present this value, and then you show how you support it. So mostly you're defining and reinforcing values. So why do you tell a story in a conversation? It's usually, in my experience, from my own storytelling, to show how I'm right. And by association with the other people in the conversation, how the rest of the conversation, the rest of the people in the conversation are also right because they agree with me, right? And so we build these little moral structures to entertain each other and to build up our own image of ourselves in our head. And it occurred to me that in my social conversations, we rarely actually explore a subject. We rarely say something like, I might have to rethink my view based on this. Instead, we say, well, you know, I came up across this guy who said this, and I took him down like this. And everybody's like, yeah, you totally did it. What a moron. And instead saying, you know, I came across this guy, told me this, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that might actually shift the way that I think. I don't know. Does that happen more often to you guys? Because it doesn't happen very often to me.
It happens more to me the older I get.
Oh.
It does. I think as we experience more in the world, we become more aware of how much we still have to learn. So I don't think it happens easily to me because I much prefer to be right than not. However, I've learned over the years that when I engage with someone where I sense this kind of a moment of, ooh, I'm starting to feel some uncomfortableness here, what I've learned to do is to go inside and say, what is it about me that's causing me to feel uncomfortable? And how can I get past that in order to have this conversation with this individual? And that has brought probably more learning to me than anything else.
That's interesting. Hmm. Yeah, it kind of seems like maybe we'd make more progress if we sort of made explicit room in a conversation for other perspectives. So instead of saying, so I met this idiot and I took him down like this, we advanced our thoughts more tentatively instead of categorically. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if our conversations might get interesting, like more interesting at the same time, because you'd be exploring ideas and people instead of building up a moral structure.
You know, I think we have to have intentional spaces for that, because I know that a lot of spaces you don't feel comfortable necessarily except putting your best face forward, right? Mm-hmm. And like you said, like showing like I'm a good person, right, and I'm a smart guy, you know, like, right, like, right, you know, I think, and you know, you said holy listening, and I had a mentor tell me that what you really need is two holy friends, mm-hmm, who will tell you, who you know love you no matter what, right? No matter at your worst, they love you, and that they'll tell you if you're being a dumbass, basically. <You know? laughs> You've got to have somebody who will really tell you the truth. And she said, those are holy friends and you need to hang on to them. And I think that's what we need. We need those kind of those spaces to be real and vulnerable, able to open ourselves up to being ridiculously wrong or, you know, it's especially like, I guess being in grad school, there's a certain element of competitiveness around me that I see with the younger people that, you know, so we don't have that a lot, you know, only in smaller groups have I found that ability to be authentic. And, you know, being older than the average student, I just kind of laugh at it. And I figure it's, you know, something that they'll that they'll get later. If, you know, if that being real is okay. I mean, we would have these Zoom classes where it was like, is everyone okay? Yeah, everyone's fine. You know, we're like, no, it's a pandemic. We're not all fine. <You
know>? Stephen, you asked earlier something about how much time do we have for this?
Yeah.
And Liz, that your experience is, that's the reality of how we live in our busyness and our competitiveness, whether we're in a corporate environment or whether we're simply engaged in conversations with others in a social realm. But I think that we don't have the luxury of time that we've had in the past simply because technology mm-hmm. and social media and all of these things that are in our life that kind of control our life right now have increased the necessary level of authenticity that we didn't have to exhibit before. We could hide behind, we're all fine, because we didn't have this kind of immediate access to information and conversation, and we're seeing each other and hearing each other right now, whereas before I would have called you three times, would have been busy, I couldn't get you, you weren't home. Now I can at any time text you and have access to you. And so our current technology, along with our current social climate, is escalating the level of authenticity that's necessary for us to have really important conversations. We can't hide behind all the things we used to hide behind anymore. So I've noticed that that seems to be quickening. The need for that seems to be quickening.
And so it seems like you're saying that that increases our need to learn to be uncomfortable as often as possible so that we can learn as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. It's our job to be holy listeners, which to me doesn't sound comfortable at all. If I'm listening to somebody else's truth and I'm letting that actually permeate me, that sounds uncomfortable to me. It sounds like, I don't know, should we, like, if we were to put something on a fridge magnet to put up on our fridge after this is over, to help us, like, do the one thing that would help us to move this conversation along, to change our hearts, to help us have the hard conversations with our white friends, even though it's hard, what would we put on that fridge magnet?
Wow, I'm not a marketing genius for that. But I do like the idea of holy friendships mm-hmm. and holy conversations and holy listening. And I think that's a key.
It sounds to me, though, like we almost need to even break further out of that, because having a holy friendship is great, but it kind of sounds like we have to have these conversations with more people and have them with more frequency.
Yeah.
To the point where, like, do we have to make everybody our holy friend? Do we?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about my bumper sticker. And my biggest challenge in talking to other white people about race right now is talking to my own family, my own extended family, my siblings, my parents, my dad, and my stepmom. You know, those are the conversations that I'm avoiding, right? And because they're fraught with all kinds of other things, right? But I know that they're family, and that they're hopefully eventually going to be okay with my stance, and maybe even understanding or trying to understand. So I think my bumper sticker would be, don't stop speaking. You know, that when I notice something, because I mean, here's how polar, you know, the situation I'm in right now with my family is that half of my family is very upset that I put Black Lives Matter on my Facebook profile picture. My I have two siblings in law enforcement, and one of them is very upset, says that Black Lives Matter is a hate group that wants all cops dead, and that if I support them, then I must want them dead. And I don't even know how to start a conversation. Like, none of this is being said directly to me. Okay, so that's a whole nother family dynamic thing, right? But I think the thing I have to remember is that, you know, if I were the person suffering under racism, I would never have the option not to be dealing with that. And so I guess that don't stop speaking, that don't run away. I believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. So I believe that even the most racist person in the world has the capacity to learn and be better, right? And so I need to give them that shot, and maybe something I say will be the first step for them. But if I don't say it, then what? What if no one's available to say it?
Let me ask a question that may be really dumb. What if your brother needs holy listening, and that's the method of changing his heart, simply because he feels holy listened to, and it helps him to see where his ideas and his fears and his hopes are coming from, but he has to defend them right now. Has he had the chance to be listened to in a holy manner?
My first little poke at you is that it's a
Do
she.
It.
It's a she.
Oh, I apologize. I'm so sorry. I thought you said your brother. Did you say a sibling?
I have two siblings.
Okay, yeah. I apologize.
Siblings in law enforcement. Yeah. I mean, and here's the thing. I know that my sister is one of the good ones. Right? Like, as far as, and I have friends on my Facebook who are like, no, all cops are bad. They're part of a bad system. It, you know, there wouldn't be bad ones getting away with stuff if the good ones spoke up. You know, I totally understand those things, but I also know I've heard a lot of stories from my sister about what it's like and how she's treated and the kinds of things she has to see that I would never want to have to deal with. You know, 95% of her work is people who are being abusive to one another in some form or another, right? Like, just heartbreaking, horrible stuff, right? So, you're right. I mean, she needs to be heard too. It's just hard when people draw a line in the sand. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you say this, then I'm out. And that's another thing going on in our current culture, that cancel culture, you know, that, like, just walk away. Just if you're conservative, just unfriend me now. Like, I see that on Facebook. Like, if you believe this, just unfriend me now. Right. So we're just simply insulating ourselves in our bubbles of people who believe just like we do. And I have no answers.
Well, that's what we came here to find out, was that we had no answers, right?
I do have a bumper sticker now, though.
We had to listen. And it actually reminds me of Jesus one more time. One of the things that I noticed about him was that a lot of the things that he did made the culture he was a part of angry with him. And it was the culture that he wanted to be a part of. He wasn't like, I don't want to be a Jew. He was a Jew. He wanted to be a part of it. But the things that he did that were the most brave were the things that made the culture that he wanted to be a part of reject him. And so, listening to you, Liz, I can understand how you would think, oh gosh, I've got to get my thing across to my sister. And I'm wondering if what Jesus was kind of trying to show us was that we have to make ourselves uncomfortable, not the other person. We have to make ourselves uncomfortable, which perhaps in this case, and I'm not trying to tell you what to do, I'm just thinking about it. Maybe it means wholly listening to a point of view that really rubs you the wrong way, because we do know that there is a soul somewhere underneath that, and that it does shine purely when we go down and find it. But we have to listen. We have to be the holy friend. Instead of finding a holy friend, hooray, I've got my holy friend. You being the holy friend, because you can listen to them and hear them down to their depths. That was what some of the professors at college did, was they listened past, I can show you newspaper opinion columns that I wrote that just horrify me now. And they were patient, and they knew that there was a guy there who was worth reaching. Mm-hmm. And it worked. They listened. They were a holy listener. So I don't know. Sometimes I think when we think about the other, you know, the person that we consider more racist than we are, I don't know, maybe we're seeing parts of ourselves in there. And by listening to them, we will hear the racist parts of us better and be able to sit with them and hopefully hear them better and integrate them more, to use Jungian psychology. I don't know. You guys got any thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's a blessing in just staying in conversation. Mm-hmm. And not walking away, and encouraging the other person not to walk away when we have a difficult conversation. I think if anything from this conversation that we've had that I've learned is that when we have a difficult conversation, if we name it up front that it's a difficult conversation, it's easier to tolerate the difficulty and the uncomfortableness of it. It's when we go in thinking it's not going to be difficult that the uncomfortableness becomes an issue and makes us back away and makes us want to, or in my case, want to fix it and get over the hard part. If I just acknowledge that this conversation is going to suck, but we're going to get through it, then that changes my commitment to interacting with another person. And it's those conversations that will help white people talk more realistically about race in ways that can bring social change. Those tough conversations.
I like that summary. What about you, Liz? Do you have a summary for us?
I think that was beautiful.
It was. I totally agree. All right. So the basic things that I've heard from this is that we need to learn to sit in our discomfort. That when we feel that discomfort, that saying something, it means that we have an opportunity to find out something about ourselves. It doesn't mean that we found an opportunity to correct somebody else. We found a reason to look inside of ourselves to see what's reacting there. And second, be a holy listener. And that's a tough thing to do on Facebook, right? It almost makes me feel like we have to find more analog ways to make this change happen. Interacting with, how do you wholly listen online? There's an entirely other episode. We should think about that. Wholly listening online.
Sounds like a Sunstone presentation.
That's it, kind of does, like, doesn't it? So, sitting in your discomfort, wholly listening, and talking more, because this does need to happen. See if you can put this on the fast track. Seek out the discomfort, so that you can make the changes that you need to make. Does that kind of wrap it up, guys? Do you feel like we're there?
Sure.
Okay. Well, thanks everyone for joining us for this week's Home Centered Sunstone. And as I said at the beginning, the point of this conversation was to hopefully take some baby steps toward what Ijoma Oluo encouraged us to do, quote, white people, talk about race with the other white people. Take some of the burden of racism off of people of color. Bring it into your life so that you can dismantle racism in the white spaces of your life. And as you can see, we've had to start at a pretty basic level, just trying to understand what even happens in conversations about race. Maybe we'll be able to talk about it at a more knowledgeable level in future episodes. And as I said at the beginning, We're interested in hearing your observations as well, the dynamics that you've seen play out in conversations about race, especially the dynamics that you've observed in yourself. What have you seen happen in conversation where everybody, however ineptly, is trying to do good? So Karen, Liz, thank you so much for being a part of this discussion. It's really helped me, and I'm really interested to see the comments that are left on this. If there are people who need to help us see some egregious mistakes that we've made in the process of this, I guess we just talked about sitting in our discomfort, so send them on over and we'll see what we can do with them. So thank you again. This has been an excellent conversation.
Thank you, Stephen.